Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's March 2022, and this is episode 278, which is a very spoiler-filled conversation about the film The Batman, directed by Matt Reeves and in theaters now. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a recent seminary graduate and also a graduate of Moody Bible Institute. He is an author for the website Christ and Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called The Batman and the Banality of Vengeance. You can read his web exclusive review at our website, equip.org, for free if you're a subscriber, because as part of your subscription, you receive the print issues and access to all of our online exclusive articles. If you do not subscribe and would like to read this review, please go to our website, equip.org, and subscribe. Cole, it's good to have you on.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
This past weekend, the film The Batman, starring Robert Pattinson of the Twilight film fame, had a huge, giant box office success in the United States. I mean, it made more than $134 million, which is only the second best opening of a film in this new pandemic era, behind a film we talked about last year, which was Spider-Man No Way Home. And so this is only the second film since December 2019 to cross this $100 million mark at the box office in the first weekend. So it's pretty amazing. Now, of course, there have been various portrayals of the character Batman from DC Comics over the years. Some people might not remember, but there was a 1960s television series about Batman, which was very, very campy. But Batman's kind of film interpretation took a little bit of a darker turn, starting in the 1990s with director Tim Burton, and Michael Keaton was the Batman during that series, and that was in the 1990s, as I said. And then after that, really the most iconic kind of modern day interpretation of Batman came from director Christopher Nolan with Christian Bale as Batman, which started that trilogy in 2005. So currently, critics are absolutely raving about this new interpretation of Batman from director Matt Reeves. So I would like you to give us a brief history of this character for listeners who are not really familiar with Batman. Specifically, what are his comic book origins, and how did Batman become so popular in pop culture?
So the Batman first appeared in Detective Comics issue number 27, way back in March 1939, less than a year after Superman took the world by storm. He was created by Bob Kane and Bill Finger for National Comics. That's the direct predecessor of DC Comics, in response to the call for more superheroes like Superman, after that character received such a good response from readers. A lot of classic pulp characters like Lee Fox, the Phantom, one of my absolute favorite characters, by the way, Johnston McCauley's Zorro, and the popular pulp hero known as the Shadow, were all part of the warp and woof of 1930s pop culture that inspired the Batman's creation. The character remained popular with audiences thanks to appearing in various forms of media throughout the years, from radio dramas to the 1960s television series with Adam West, like you mentioned, the campy 60s show that everybody sort of makes fun of now. In the late 80s and 90s became pretty firmly embedded in the modern imagination thanks to the Tim Burton film, which was very popular when it came out, and then the animated series, Bruce Timm's animated series, which was also very popular in the 90s. That's sort of what I grew up with, and won multiple Emmy Awards. So the character has always been a bit of a hit with audiences. And one of the things you have to understand about comic books, especially Batman comic books, and the nature of modern culture is that things change very rapidly. Characters that become icons like Batman and Superman are constantly being reinvented. So when someone watches a Batman movie, for example, and then asks, is that in the comics? Well, the answer is very likely at some point, yes, but it might not be, you know, considered canon or whatever anymore. I always encourage people who are trying to get into reading a specific comic book character to pick a writer that they like and just start by reading that particular writer's work, because the nuances of character do change with every writer. That being said, there is a sort of baseline mythology for Batman that everyone knows. As a child, Bruce Wayne witnessed his very wealthy socialite parents, you know, their murder. He witnessed their murder, which scarred him emotionally and psychologically, and eventually leads him to becoming a vigilante as an adult dressed as a bat who goes out, you know, fights crime and fictional Gotham City. The specifics can change and often do, but that's a very basic silhouette of the character that pretty much everybody, I think, knows at this point, and all of the writers more or less adhere to.
The Batman film takes this character in a lot of ways back to his comic book roots, and the film is getting a very good response, both from film critics and with general audiences. Now, this is the third reimagining of this character beyond, you know, the campy 1960s TV show that we mentioned. And this character has been reimagined several times in the past few decades. Of course, we've got the one that was done by Tim Burton in the 1990s with Michael Keaton as Batman. We have the Christopher Nolan, very highly regarded films about Batman, Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. But currently, as far as Rotten Tomatoes is concerned, this Matt Reeves directed version, The Batman, is the highest audience score that it has had in terms of Batman interpretations. So why do you think it is that audiences keep responding to this character? I mean, what makes this Matt Reeves directed interpretation stand out from the other ones by Nolan and Tim Burton?
Well, I think the character is malleable because audiences have come to expect him to be reinvented. I mean, it's really not that strange of a phenomenon. Just look at James Bond. I mean, a lot of people thought that series would die without Sean Connery, but Roger Moore came in and reinvented it. And in many ways, you could say that his run on Bond was more successful than Connery's, just in terms of longevity. So I think audiences will respond to a character who is iconic, and Batman is a very iconic character. It's actually become quite an exciting thing to see who is going to be portraying the next Batman and how they're going to interpret the character. We really do live in the age of doing the same thing but differently, which very unironically sort of began with two movies that came out a year apart, Batman Begins and Casino Royale. So Batman and James Bond really represent the shift in movie-making ideology for the 21st century thus far, or at least, you know, popular blockbuster movie-making. What's interesting about what Matt Reeves does with this new film is he sort of takes the character back to these comic book roots. A little over 10 years ago now, it was actually a Batman comic, Detective Comics issue 871, that got me back into reading comics, you know, full time. it was the beginning of Scott Snyder's run writing the Batman character, which would go on to become a number one New York Times bestseller. That particular storyline, right before the comics rebooted with the New 52, was a very stripped down and back to basics detective story. And it really does channel the original conceit of the character. I think people sort of forget that when Batman first started, there was no Justice League or this concept of shared continuity storytelling. These characters like Batman and Superman and very soon after Wonder Woman managed to exist on their own. I mean, when Batman first appeared, he was a detective of sorts. He was a bit like Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. That was one of the inspirations behind the character. And the very first Batman story is something like a murder mystery. There were none of these iconic villains that we have now. And over the years, different writers have played that angle when writing the character. And the idea of Batman as a detective, first and foremost, a vigilante who can go where the cops can't, get answers that maybe they couldn't while working within the confines of the law, that is something that has been part of the character's DNA from the very beginning. There are very popular comic book storylines that have definitely taken the character in the same direction. That's really the interpretation, at least on screen, that Matt Reeves is going with for this film. I think it stands out because of how deeply psychological and complex it is. This is absolutely not a film for children. It is very moody, and it's a dark crime film about the corruption of good men. It's a noir film in the truest sense of the word, and we haven't really seen that on the silver screen before, at least not from a Batman adaptation.
So one of the things that some of the fans have noted about this particular film is that it's taking some of its inspiration from the Batman comic series, The Long Halloween. That was like 13 issues published by DC back in the 1990s. So why did he look to that particular series as inspiration? And do you agree with the fans that, yeah, it has the similar beats to it?
Yeah. Okay. So The Long Halloween is a big inspiration for this particular film, just as it was for Nolan's movies. In the theater that I went to, I saw the film ahead of release. We were actually given copies of the first issue of The Long Halloween. So that's a very key storyline. Like you noted, The Long Halloween by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale is one of the most important comic book titles in the last 30 years, originally published between 1996 and 1997. And it's set during the early days of Bruce's time as the Batman. And it's this really, like you said, gritty type of crime saga that deals with these crime families, and it ropes in, you know, the corrupt politicians, and it deals with Harvey Dent, who would later become Two-Face. And that storyline really did for the comics, in a sense, what Matt Reeves' film is doing for the cinematic adaptations, which is to sort of strip Batman of the, in a sense, larger-than-life status that he's acquired over time, and to take him back to his roots in the sense of telling a very down-in-the-gutter, grimy crime story. Honestly, feels a bit more like a gangster film that you're going to see in maybe the 1970s than anything else. And for those who are not comic book inclined or just not interested in, you know, picking up the Long Halloween book and reading it, on HBO Max, actually, there is a two-part animated adaptation of The Long Halloween that really is tremendous. Don't let the fact that it's animated fool you. It's not for kids. The second part is rated R, I believe. But those are sitting at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, if you care about that sort of thing. And I've watched them both, and they are really quite good. They're solid adaptations of really a great, great run in comics. But anyway, the Long Halloween is a clear inspiration for this film. So is Frank Miller's classic Year One story. I don't think you can really get away from that one. It sort of rewrites Batman's origin in a lot of ways and shows his early time shows Bruce's early time as Batman and just how much of a struggle that was to find a groove. Another inspiration that's been talked about by Matt Reeves is a brilliant little Batman story by the late Darwin Cook called Ego. I think it's something like 60 pages. I think it is. It's a short read, but it's a really fascinating dive into the psychology of Batman, and I've always loved it. And Darwin Cook's art is something else. So that's one of my favorite stories. And then, and by way of spoilers, Scott Snyder's 0 Year storyline, which is actually pretty recent. It came out less than a decade ago, but reinvented the Riddler, who is the villain of this film. And that comic reinvented him really as a force to be reckoned with, and he brings Gotham to its knees by flooding the city, which is a pretty major plot point in the new film. So those are just some of the comic book inspirations for what Matt Reeves has done with his film. But I have to say that this new film is not a retread of the usual comic book stuff. There are some inspirations, obviously, that are taken, but this is very much Matt Reeves' film. And this movie owes far more to classic noir films and 1970s crime thrillers, especially The French Connection, Chinatown, Taxi Driver, those kinds of movies, as well as David Fincher films like Seven and Zodiac, than it does to the usual comic book movie genre. So this is a Batman movie that really is quite different from anything we've seen on screen.
We are starting a brand new giveaway, and the deadline to enter is June 30, 2022. It is for not only a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, which includes all of the print issues to your door, plus the online access that's just for subscribers at our website for all of the exclusive online content. You can take that subscription and extend your own subscription or give it as a gift to someone else. There is also the addition of these four books as swag as part of the giveaway package. We have two books that are the best of the Christian Research Journal from over the years. One is an apologetics book called What is Truth? The other one focuses on articles that we have published about ethics called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals? In addition, we have a book called Doubts About Darwin by Thomas Woodward and a book by one of our journal authors, Paul J. Gould, called Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience and Imagination in a Disenchanted World. Now, the book part of the giveaway package is only available to those residents or subscribers in the United States, or listeners rather, also to this podcast, even if you're not subscribing, and it's only for the US. But the complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal is available to everyone worldwide. So please do enter in at Apple Podcasts, which is the best way for us to track the entries. Of course, we welcome starred reviews, but the only way that we can track the entries is if you give us a short written review. So thank you for that. And hop on to Apple Podcasts and search for Postmodern Realities Podcast. Now, we are so grateful for all the ways in which you partner with us, which includes subscribing to our journal for $33.50 at equip.org. And of course, during these times, we recognize that not everybody has it in their budget right now to subscribe to the journal. So we are really grateful for you to help us to continue to bring you this podcast as we have done for the past 6 years. You can give us a tip at equip.org and just go to magazine at the drop-down Postmodern Realities Podcast. And for every single one of our episodes that we've had over the last 6 years, at any of those landing pages, you will find a link to give us a tip. So we thank you for that. Plus, just get the word out. As always, I say, tell a friend, email or text your favorite links to any of these particular episodes that you really enjoy and get the word out. I mean, this podcast really is for every Christian that wants to be equipped to defend their faith. Plus, you have a lot of the cultural apologetics that we do, which I think would be of great interest to youth groups and kids in college and people trying to figure out, well, how do I use some of the latest cultural, you know, films and TV series and books to jumpstart a conversation about Christianity. So thank you for your partnership. Well, before we get into our spoiler-filled discussion specifically about this film, I have to talk to you and just ask you, you know, straight up about how Christians should approach this character and also this film, because it was interesting when I sat in the theater with a friend of mine and it started, I was just like, hey, what is this rated? And we were watching it for a few minutes and we turned to each other, oh, this must be R. But it's not rated R, it's rated PG-13. And it's a very dark film in some places. Not just the fact that the setting itself is very gritty, but the themes are extremely mature. And so I'm just wondering how Christians should handle this. And also, I just want to ask you to really elaborate on what you already mentioned, that this is kind of more in the film noir genre that the director has put it in versus, you know, more of the typical superhero Marvel type film. So why don't you speak to both of those things? Because again, this, one of the iconic things that he says in this film, like, what is your name? It's just like, I'm vengeance. So, okay, how do Christians process that? And the very, I think, very adult themes in a PG-13 film.
Yeah. So I will say I was just as shocked. I know we talked about this sort of right in the aftermath. I was just as shocked that it was PG-13 and then to kind of deal with what they were dealing with on screen. I can completely see how this film would have been an R. and from what I understand, I don't know how true this is, but from what I understand and some of the things I've read, that the original cut of the movie was something like 4 hours or over 4 hours long. And this was stuff that I was seeing maybe a year ago when the first screening started happening, when it was still being edited. And I kind of thought, based on what was said, that it would be an R rating then, which I thought was kind of interesting, because usually these movies, these big blockbusters featuring these iconic characters are PG-13 because you get more money, obviously, that way. So I'm sure that some stuff was trimmed out to help it hit that PG-13 rating. But yeah, I was shocked. This could easily have been an R-rated film. And again, I don't recommend anyone taking their children to this movie.
I mean, it's PG-13. And so you think, you know, a lot of parents would be like, oh, it's PG-13. I can take my middle schooler who's 12, and I would not allow a 12-year-old to
watch. No, not at
film.
All. To put this in perspective, this film has the same rating as the most recent Spider-Man movie.
Which is kind of wild because
it's mind-boggling.
That one you could, And the other thing that made me think it's R, because anytime they use an F-bomb one or two times, it's like immediate R. So I'm surprised it wasn't that. But again, it's the themes themselves and how they're depicted, because they kind of don't leave anything to the imagination. And what I'm talking about more is the violent undertone.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It is, it's quite shocking in places. The violence is very visceral and sort of can jump up and come out of nowhere of sorts. So it's something to be aware of when you go to see this movie. Now, you had mentioned the connection to the film noir genre. This is interesting because a lot of, let's say, Christian critics, I know, will assert that in some ways the film noir genre, that really is the big inspiration for this movie, and you know, Christianity are incompatible. But to answer this question, I'm actually going to appeal to a guy by the name of J. Mark Bertrand. He is a committed Christian, a conservative Presbyterian teaching elder, and a crime novelist. In an issue of By Faith magazine, which is the big PCA magazine in America, he wrote an article back in 2011 titled Writing About Reprobation. And in this article, he gives a really stellar defense of the noir genre and how Christians can and should approach it. It's an article that I have kept on hand for 10 years and always go to in this situation. In this article, he writes, "The moral failure that noir fiction assumes is not just individual. It is systemic, obsessed not with the bad apple or the single sin, but with the pervasive human corruption that makes a mockery of our pretensions to goodness, law, and order." And that is honestly one of the best descriptors for the noir genre that I've ever come across. I have always sort of had to defend my deep and abiding love of this particular genre to a lot of my Christian friends who don't quite understand why someone would even bother entertaining a genre like this. And actually, I just want to say this for clarification. I'm using the word genre here because it's how most people talk about noir fiction. But the truth is, noir is really a tone or an attitude, what many people deem as cynical. The attitude of noir fiction, and it is very much the attitude of this new Batman film, is that no one gets out of this world clean. Or the way the psalmist says it, no one is righteous, no, not even one, no one understands, no one seeks for God. It's a perspective that looks at the world and says, I don't care how clean you think you are not spotless, and even on your best day, you still have some flaws as a human being. And in a culture that is so consumed with superficiality, with keeping up appearances, which is a state of being so exacerbated by social media that you can have a whole separate persona in the digital world, this perspective absolutely comes across as cynical and as hopeless in a lot of ways. And that's unfortunate because it is not that noir comes without hope. It just wants to make sure that true goodness is not gotten on the cheap. It is not watered down. It understands that goodness in a fallen world is actually hard work. That it's so much easier to just revert to your default setting and become stale and embittered, numb at worst to the world, to evil in the world. There is no such thing as a good guy in noir because all are corrupt, or in other words, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. It leans into that particular aspect in reality for the purpose of painting goodness in stronger colors. And that is quite literally the point of this new Batman film. I mean, it is no coincidence that this movie begins, like you said, with Batman calling himself Vengeance and beating these thugs to a pulp. But then it ends with him saying that Batman has to become more than just a symbol of retribution if Gotham is going to survive and rebuild. And the last shots are during daybreak, and he's rescuing people, not beating them. So no, I don't think this genre is antithetical to Christianity at all. I think it's antithetical to a very cheap version of Christianity that has a very weak view of sin and evil. And I think it's that very viewpoint that these kinds of stories are trying to shake you out of. When I teach biblical literature, I tell my students sometimes to read Raymond Chandler, the classic noir fiction writer, if they want to get a good illustration of how deeply affected the human condition is by sin. And now I'm just glad I can point people to a very good and very popular film to illustrate the same thing. So all that to say, no, I don't think Christianity is at odds with the noir genre or the noir perspective on things. In fact, I would say that it sort of makes the true power of the gospel quite overwhelming when you realize that sin is that pervasive in the world, and that no one gets out of this world clean, but that through the imputed righteousness of Christ, you are justified. It really is mind-boggling from that perspective.
So another thing that this movie kind of touches on is deals with current, I would say, political concepts and things like the idea of white privilege and the use of somebody, specifically people who are in like a terrorist category, to use social media to follow them and incite violence, which has been, you know, proven when things have happened. Somebody had a social media account and people were watching them live stream some violent thing or talking about violence that they're going to do on social media. So this is throughout the narrative of the film. So do you think that this is a movie that is designed to like maybe attack conservative political ideas?
It's a good question. No, I don't think that's what Reeves is trying to do at all. People are going to see it that way, I'm sure, and the people who are going to get offended by it are the people who are looking to get offended by it. The movie incorporates these ideas, but it's just as critical of terrible responses to those ideas as anything else. I mean, look at the character of Selina Kyle, the Catwoman figure. She's the one who name-checks white privilege when talking about all of these rich white people being the problem in Gotham. The irony of that is that she cannot fathom for a moment that the man under the mask she's talking to is the richest white guy in the city. Her own viewpoint is so skewed in the other direction that she sees them all as very corrupt and deserving of a bullet. Batman, on the other hand, is looking at all the criminals in Gotham thinking they're just scum. But when he meets people like Selina, he begins to rethink his perspective on things. It turns out that she's not just another drug dealer, that she's actually really intricately connected to his investigation, and she has some pretty understandable motivations, despite the fact that her solution to the problem, which is to just shoot it, isn't the best. And that's what really elevates this film to the level of what I would argue is good cinema. Every character has a complex but clear motivation for doing what they do. The cleanest character in the whole movie, the one who is the least corrupt, is James Gordon, the only guy that the Batman really trusts. He's played by Jeffrey Wright here. It's a very, very good performance. And it's the way these different perspectives come up against and hold up mirrors to each other that really lends the movie its strength. Incorporating these ideas, social media, for example, the social unrest in Gotham, the corruption of the city leaders. I mean, this is just how Reeves contextualizes his story to our current day and age. And he doesn't do it in a way that's cheap or condescending. I mean, he really is interested in examining these perspectives and turning them over and probing the psychology of the characters in interesting ways. And you go, well, how do you know that? Because the movie's 3 hours long. He spends 3 hours doing this. Very few films could even get away with that. So no, I don't think people should be afraid of this movie. I think if anything, it invites very serious reflection on whether it's right to just start ripping apart social structures because you don't like the way it looks. How far are you willing to go before you start hurting the people who disagree with you? Maybe you don't even have a good frame of reference for understanding the other person. And that's certainly the case with both Bruce and Selina. They begin by misunderstanding each other, and over the course of the film, have to build a degree of respect. But that doesn't mean they don't come to blows about it. And they certainly do. You said to me right after you saw it, it's not a definitive ending. And that's the point, I think. It's sort of like the Book of Jonah, in a sense, which doesn't give you any easy closure. It leaves the door open for the reader to think about how much like Jonah they are. And that's what I find really brilliant about how Reeves has told this story. And it's sort of shocking that this even got made. He plays the audience against themselves. It's really fascinating. And not I would argue, Rian Johnson with The Last Jedi does a very similar thing. Matt Reeves does it quite differently. He plays the audience against themselves. I mean, the very things that they're going to be cheering about when the movie begins is the very thing that he's going to indict by the time the credits roll. And that's very bold. It's really ambitious, and I'm absolutely shocked a studio allowed him to take a property as big as Batman and bring such a singular and daring creative vision to it. I'm glad they did it. But, you know, Disney, it seems, would implode before ever even so much as entertaining the idea of letting someone be this risky with a major character. The Eternals tried it, but nobody knows who those characters are, so they could get away with it. This is Batman, arguably the most popular superhero today. It's a very bold move on Reeves' part. And no, so to your question about the film being designed to attack conservatives or anything like that, no, I don't think it should be read that way at all. I think if you followed the narrative, it's much more complex and interested in examining different points of view on some of these social issues. And it's a very modern movie in that sense.
I have two things I want to ask you about. First is, I'm just wondering, in this story, it's the first time I've seen that Bruce Wayne's parents aren't made out to be just stellar, upstanding people in the community. Like, they have some things that they are wrestling with. Usually just kind of get the backstory of Bruce Wayne's parents in movies in the past where he's there, you know, brutally murdered after being mugged. And of course, that orphans Bruce Wayne. But how is this done in the comics? I mean, does some of the stuff that come out in this movie also in the comics, because his dad is portrayed as having a corrupt side or linked to the corruption in Gotham City, but it was out of his desire to protect his wife and some of her struggles from getting out into the news media during when his dad was running for office in Gotham. And then also I want to ask you, you know, in your review, you talk about how director Matt Reeves deconstructs both the character of Batman and actually the superhero film genre itself. And actually, I think this is similar to the review that you wrote for us about Logan, which for our listeners who might be new, back in episode 222, we had a discussion about the film Logan and Cole's article, Deconstructionism and the Gospel Hope in Logan, is available for free online at our website, equip.org. And you can also listen to the episode related to that Logan discussion. But what makes these, you know, subversive kind of movies so popular with audiences? I mean, do you think that they're important to help this particular genre grow and expand?
Yeah, it's come up before in the comics. So this is sort of what I cushioned this whole discussion by saying when people often ask about, is this in the comics? Well, chances are, given just the huge amount of content that has been written over the years, that idea has been floated in by a writer at some point. Whether or not it's considered current continuity with what the comics are doing, you know, that just sort of depends on the continuity you're looking at and the editors at DC. What's funny is that we are very much a culture, due in part because of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that is like continuity obsessed. We've got to try to find a way to make everything fit. Look, if you've been reading comics for more than 2 weeks, you understand that, you know, that is hopeless. That's the reason they keep resetting their continuities in comics, is because they can't keep track of all this stuff. It grows beyond their control. And so you just kind of accept that, well, yeah, it depends on the writer. And this guy's stuff, yeah, it's there. And this guy's stuff, it might not be. The idea of whether or not the Waynes have not always been these, you know, paragons in Gotham's history. Yeah, it's been played with in the comics before, but it's not what I would say mainstream. It's certainly jarring. Like you said, you've never quite seen it taken in that direction. It is quite jarring to see on screen, and it is a huge, you know, point that is made in this movie. It's actually a major point in Bruce's character arc here. But deconstructionism as a whole, to answer that part of the question, is something that I'm not really a huge fan of because it can be so cynical. And let me try to put a little meat on the bone for anyone who isn't quite sure what we're talking about when we say deconstructionism. Deconstructionism is a philosophical movement and literary theory, for lack of a better word, that questions traditional assumptions about meaning and truth. Now, if that puts you to sleep, I'm sorry, but you know, it's definitely something you should probably sit up and pay attention to, because it's very likely exactly what your kid is being taught to do in school, which is to question ultimate meaning. Let me give you an example of this. I actually heard this in seminary, okay? when the writer of Hebrews says that Abraham was willing to let the knife fall on Isaac because he believed in God's power to raise the dead, the writer of Hebrews is assigning meaning that isn't actually there. In other words, the writer of Hebrews is making this up. It's their reading of the material. Might be true, might not be. It's speculation on the part of the writer of Hebrews. Now, you can start to see in that light how this gets problematic real quick. Well, if there's suddenly no clear and discernible meaning, then how on earth do you know what something means? And deconstructionism goes, right. It calls into question our ability to discern meaning and therefore ultimate truth. If you've ever heard the name Jacques Derrida, that's where a lot of the school of thought comes from. Now, I will hear a lot of conservative Christian thinkers go, deconstructionism is wrong all the time. Personally, I look at it and go, well, except for when the structures that it's deconstructing or dismantling are bad structures to begin with. Christians themselves, especially apologists, would employ what looks a lot like deconstructionist tactics in a debate, to deconstruct the perspective of an atheist, for example. And that is, as a whole, this approach, this philosophy of doing things, I guess, of telling a story, is something the Batman, the film, does quite well. It deconstructs a lot of these characters that general audiences have come to almost deify. The very idea of a man who dresses up as a bat and goes out there to fight criminals is a little off-kilter. Something is amiss. By the same token, just going around and, shooting these criminals that you think deserve it maybe isn't the best way to see justice dispensed either. What's interesting that Reeves is so a part of the conversation when he brings the gun scene with Catwoman into play, because you'll often hear it said regarding the character of Batman that, well, your life would be so much simpler if you would just, kill some of these villains. Maybe, maybe not. That's what Reeves is leaning into. He sort of teases some of these ideas out to see where they go and say, it doesn't quite work that way. You might not like the system when it fails, but when it works, it works. And that's Batman's perspective with Selina when he stops her from using the gun. He's got enough faith in a system, or at least a system that can be one day, that he doesn't give in to just going around and offing people, even if they deserve it, and even if it would be a little bit easier in some cases. And Reeves, to his credit, though he wades into these muddy waters and creates a lot of ambiguity, I would say, he doesn't leave you hanging. It's an irresolution of an ending narratively, but thematically, he doesn't leave you hanging. He does leave you, like I said, in a sense, narratively, but he actually has Bruce Wayne figure out that he can't just go around beating the ever-loving snot out of bad guys and expecting Gotham to become a better place for it. Something has to change if there is going to be a better tomorrow. In general, yes, I think these kinds of movies have to come along and subvert audience expectations to help audiences figure out what it is they like about these characters in the first place. It keeps things fresh. It keeps us from ever getting too comfortable. And to be completely honest, I am actually very surprised this film is doing as well as it is. I know after I saw it, I think I messaged you about it and said this is a film that's going to divide general audiences. I told one of my friends who's going to see it tomorrow, when I first saw it, he was asking me about it, and I told him, this is going to be the Last Jedi for Batman movies, because the theater audience that I... when I was there, they were very confused. Even though it keeps things fresh and it's different, I'm just surprised the film has done so well. Nobody seemed to know what to think in my screening when it was over with. Normally you have, the people clapping or whatever, and that didn't happen. People were just sort of confused. And I think that's a testament to how much effort has been put into running your expectations for what Batman is and supposed to be right back at you, because that's exactly what Reeves does, and it's a very bold thing to do, but clearly it's working.
So I want to talk specifically about the character of Bruce Wayne in this particular film. In your review, you write about how this film, The Batman, portrays him being almost as damaged as his villains, and I would say that he comes across as almost really depressed or just, he's almost obsessed. I mean, he seems, you know, in past interpretations of Batman, you've always seen him like really have, even in the Nolan films, really have this distinct other side of him. Here's the Batman, but then here he is schmoozing with all the people in town, where you don't really get that when he shows up at a funeral in the film. Everyone's like, oh, this is Bruce Wayne. Like, where's he been? It's, so he has a very just almost depressed or moody, or more than that, just kind of obsessed maybe with his side, his alter ego as the Batman, Bruce Wayne does. And so do you think that this is an accurate characterization of him being almost as damaged as the villain in this film and the main villain? And actually, the main villain says to him at the end of the film, you know, we're not that much different. We're similar, except for you have been, speaking of white privilege, looking down upon all of us. You know, even though we were both orphans, it's not the same for you because you were a billionaire. But you just get this idea of Bruce Wayne that he's very different than I've seen even the Christopher Nolan vision of Bruce Wayne be.
Yeah, he's nuts.
He's obsessed. He's got this obsessive side.
It's a psychosis. It's a full-on psychosis.
I mean, the Batcave is not cool. I mean, the Batcave is spooky. It's like kind of, it's in a bad part of town. I'm not really, it's not that
That should have cool been the title Batcave. Of this review. The Batcave is not cool.
Well, it's not that, you know, you always gotten this, oh. It's
no, you're right. It is.
You know, it's not like that.
Yeah, no, it's everything. You know, one of the things I appreciated about the film, and I remember watching Robert Pattinson talk about this pretty early on in a video, is everything feels very handmade. It's practical. And the Batcave definitely feels that way in this movie. It's just, he made do with what he had. But it is interesting. This is by far the most psychologically and emotionally complex take on Bruce Wayne ever put to screen. What I appreciate is something that I've talked about with my friends and other comic book nerds for a very long time, which is that at least in this initial vision, from what I understand, this is supposed to be the start of a new trilogy along with some other HBO Max shows. I'm not really sure where the story is going to go, but based on what we've got, right, looking at the context of what we have, Batman is not a hero. And I will say that again. Batman is not a hero. Batman is the very warped way, a man who is understandably emotionally damaged due to watching both of his parents get murdered in front of him, deals with his childhood trauma. It is a manifestation of anger and rage that is absolutely not healthy. It is, like you said, an obsession or a kind of fixed psychosis. Like, the dude can't even go outside without having sunglasses on. If any of us actually knew Bruce Wayne in real life and learned what he did, the first thing we would do is say, hey, bud, you need help. Serious, serious help. And in this film, that is basically the perspective that Alfred, his Bruce Wayne's, you know, iconic butler, has on all of this. In this movie, he's actually in it very little. He's played by Andy Serkis, a fully analog, by the way, Andy Serkis.
Of Gollum fame, in case people are wondering.
Yeah, of Gollum, Snoke, that character from the new Star Wars movies. Yeah, that's Andy Serkis, but he's just completely him at this point. I think he also did Caesar in Matt Reeves' Planet of the Apes movies. Anyway, that Alfred's perspective on this is, he thinks Bruce is off his rocker. And he's right. They're very much at odds for most of this movie, and their relationship is not, you know, cordial. If Bruce is going to go out there dressed as this demented figure and try to help people, he's got to find a way to do it in a way that doesn't drive him further into his own psychosis. And that is a lot about what the film discusses. Bruce sees himself as vengeance. I mean, that's what he calls himself as Batman. It's what other characters call him. He doesn't even say, I'm Batman. He says, I'm vengeance. It's how he conceives of himself and what he's doing. Well, at the end of this film, one of the villains, this social media cult member who follows the Riddler, the big villain in this movie, says the same thing, I'm vengeance, when they pull the mask off. And it's at that moment that Bruce sees it. It's like a mirror being held up, that if he's not careful, if the Batman doesn't come to stand for something more than just violent retribution, the problem persists and he's no better than the bad guys. The thing the Riddler points out to him is that his position of wealth, of, despite having some rough things happen to him, his position of wealth has blinded him to that in a lot of ways. Vengeance is banal when it's just revenge for the sake of revenge. And it's not healthy at all. In an interview that Matt Reeves gave with Esquire, I think, he said he was inspired to write Bruce Wayne in this film as a drug addict by listening to Nirvana and Kurt Cobain. Yes, I think it is a very fitting characterization. The comics have not quite interrogated Bruce's psychology in this way. Some of them have come fairly close. Darwin Cook's Ego is really kind of an interesting read in this respect. And just recently, there was a really brilliant comic book writer named Tom King who did something very similar in his run on Batman. He basically comes at the character from this angle of Batman being a very bad emotional crutch for a man who just deals with trauma in unhealthy ways. And I think that's a very fair reading of the character, and it's certainly the reading that Matt Reeves goes with here.
So I want to talk a little bit about the character that you mentioned, Selina Kyle, who is played by Zoe Kravitz as Catwoman, and their, you know, what their romance is like in the comics versus this on-screen interpretation of her, and then like kind of a backstory. And as a matter of fact, when you're talking about HBO Max, since she, at the end of the film, she's going her separate ways from Batman, I can see some kind of origin story from her as a series, a standalone series on HBO Max for sure. But what about how this film portrays their romance and interaction?
Yeah, you almost wonder if it can be called a romance in this film. It's definitely flirtatious, but there's it's nothing really more than that at different points. And they one of the interesting things about their relationship in this film is that they move seamlessly between ally and enemy. Of course, Catwoman comes around at the end to helping him, but you know there are some moments where they come to blows. And what's interesting is that is very much how the comics have portrayed Bruce and Selina over the years. She is far and away Batman's best-known love interest, but their relationship is in and out, you know, love-hate, as you would call it. And she's a classic comic book character. She was actually created by the same people who created Batman. She debuted in 1940. I think it was pretty early in 1940, and if I'm not mistaken, this was after Batman became popular and got his own comic book just called Batman. She appeared in the very first issue of that. So she's been around for a long time, and their relationship has always been that same kind of flirtatious, but you never know if she's a villain, never know if she's a hero. I know that oftentimes a lot of your nerd outlets, comic book news outlets, will do like rankings of villains and heroes. And I know that she's shown up on both lists. She's very much an anti-hero in that way. One of the more interesting developments in the comics, since you ask about them, is I mentioned Tom King's run on Batman, who sort of sees the Batman persona as an emotional crutch that Bruce Wayne uses to basically keep himself emotionally stuck. It's the way that he cripples himself in a lot of ways. In that storyline, actually, he proposes to Selina. And Tom King's run really does become this very long and drawn-out love affair between Batman and Catwoman. I think he's doing another series now that's very similar. It's not finished yet. COVID caused it to get pushed back, but it's called Batman Catwoman. It plays with the same ideas. But it was a pretty big event. Comic book fans still, you know, sort of know it as the wedding. If you walk up to any Batman reader and say, "Oh, the wedding," they're going to go, "Oh yeah, Batman, Catwoman." Yeah, they know what that is. So that was a whole storyline very recently in the comics. But as far as how their relationship is portrayed in this film, it's very close to how the relationship has traditionally been shown in the comic books.
So this movie has both, you know, like an old-fashioned vibe in the way that it's being filmed, you know, with, you know, its effects and lighting, but also very contemporary because of the subject matter in which, you know, they are using around whether it's social issues or just the kind of ethos and setting of the film. So it's kind of an interesting blend of both of those. What do you think, though, that the director, Matt Reeves, is ultimately trying to say in this particular interpretation of the Batman mythos? You know, what is he saying as a director? And is this something that is worth noting?
Well, Reeves himself said in an interview with Time that he wanted to unsettle audiences, that he wanted to play the expectation of what Batman represents against you just a little bit. It's that scene at the beginning, I'm Vengeance, and the audience is sitting there eager to watch Batman beat these thugs senseless. And then in the aftermath, you start to realize, oh, maybe that's not actually helping Gotham become a better place. This is a guy who is quite literally a fearmonger. The whole opening montage is about that. And what begins with him stalking the shadows, beating up bad guys, ends with him carrying this little girl to safety in the light of dawn. He comes out of the shadows. He ends up helping people in very tangible ways. As Gotham rebuilds, he rebuilds the image of the Batman along with it as someone who is capable of compassion and a willingness to sacrifice. Batman doesn't become, you know, Superman by the time the film ends, but he moves ever so slightly, and that's the key. He thaws just a little bit. He starts to come out of that depression. Bruce isn't going to shed his scars overnight, but he has a new awareness of how trauma doesn't just, you know, heal very quickly, and dealing with it in unhealthy ways can hurt both you and others. And I think there's something quite profound about that. In a very cynical time, especially with social media as vitriolic and rampant as it is, I do think this is a movie that we need right now. As mature and dark and grim as it is, it's an indictment of all of those things as well. And that's something that's worth your time for far more than many of the other big blockbusters that have come out lately. It really is worth your time, and it really is a good movie. Long. It's a long film, but it's pure cinema.
Yes, it is 3 hours long if our listeners want to know if they want to invest the time. I have one final question for you. You know, I guess the younger generation has kind of grown up on this Marvel cinematic universe where everyone has superpowers or particular weapons that they use that they're identified with, so they're not, you know, just humans. Whereas this interpretation, I mean, he's a guy with some definitely mental health issues. How should we look at this kind of, you know, we typically thought of superheroes maybe more in a campy way, like we talked about the 60s TV series, but this is different. I mean, this is not like, you know, a Jedi with a special sword or, you know, special healing powers or like Superman can see X-ray vision. So how do we put him in kind of that superhero pantheon? Like, it's something different than we're used to with Marvel, I'd say.
Yeah, well, that's what I think Reeves is trying to do here. And there's a very specific reason that these other characters like Superman and Wonder Woman don't fit in this movie. There's no room for them. They're not even mentioned. It's not even treated as if it's, you know, a shared cinematic universe or anything like that. This is just Batman as a man. And that's always kind of been sort of the questions. And to me, it has always been the most comical part, no pun intended, of comic books. For example, in Justice League, the old animated show from the, I say old, from the 90s, early 2000s, but the older Justice League TV series, you know, these characters have a space station, which is also in the comics. And, you know, my friends have heard me say this so many times. The goofiest thing to me is Batman on a space station. It's absurd. It really is absurd. And it's such a comic book thing to do. Whereas the Batman stories I've always been drawn to are stories like The Long Halloween or Ego or Zero Year or the Black Mirror that Scott Snyder did on Detective Comics, which are these earthier kind of gritty, down-to-earth tales. And that's really what Reeves channels in this movie. As far as how we fit him in this pantheon, the point is that I don't think we're supposed to. He's a human. He is very much a human, someone, like you said, in this movie with mental issues. And the what's interesting there is I think that's what makes Batman so relatable. It's why, despite the popularity of all of these other heroes right now, Batman is, you know, really arguably the most popular superhero going. You look at the number of reinventions he's had, you look at how well Christopher Nolan's films did, basically reinventing the comic book movie, and now you get another film that basically does the same thing with the same character. not, you know, 15 years later, and people are still turning out in droves to see it. I think he's very relatable in that sense. And there's just something about tragic characters that we love, and Batman is a very tragic character, even when he's not portrayed necessarily as being a tragic character. Like in Zack Snyder's films, he is still a tragic character. We love tragedies. We love train wrecks. we like watching them. And I think Batman is a character that you can always go to and count on to challenge your conceptions of the world and to aspire to in some ways. That being said, I don't think Batman is a hero. And that is where we sort of misread things in a broad sense. Batman is very much the emotional crutch of a man who just refuses to move past some trauma. Not saying it's easy to do, but saying he refuses to get help. And he has a lot of pride that's wrapped up in that. And he's very committed to his ideologies. But those ideologies can sometimes lead him to misread situations and even to gauge situations the wrong way and do, you know, maybe not the right things. And that's what Reeves is interesting in leaning into, and I'm completely fine with that. I think it's interesting, and I think it shows that audiences respond to it.
At the very end of the movie, he has a conversation with Catwoman, and it leaves you with a sense of hope, a glimmer of hope. In other words, why is he even going to stay? She says, hey, why don't we leave this place? And yet he wants to stay in Gotham City. Do you think he's turning the corner a little bit from 100% being vengeance and out to just really do harm to those people who are evil? Or do you think there's just a note of hope that you're left with?
Oh, no, I think the point is that he's turning the corner. You're starting to see it. The ending really is a brilliant contrast to the beginning of the movie. It's really a great bookend. And I think this is a movie that warrants multiple viewings if you can stomach sort of the darkness to it. But, you know, the opening is that monologue, which is a very noir thing to do. The opening detective monologue. And then you see him, you know, beating those guys in darkness. The end of the movie is a final monologue, but it's dawn and he's helping people. And he even shows the bat signal, which he begins the movie talking about how it's this icon of fear. And the closing montage, it shows the signal again, but he's saying this has to be more than that. It can't just be fear. So I think the point is that he's turning the corner, and you see the difference in perspectives there because they literally stand at a crossroads. And she's saying, you know, just leave. You give up on the city. It's never going to change. But he stays. And that's where I say, you know, this genre is not incompatible with Christianity at all. It just, goodness comes at a cost. It comes at a very, very high cost. And you can't turn a blind eye to that. If he's going to stay and help these people, he has got to change. He has got to really step up and become something other. He has to grow beyond himself and lose his pride and lose the whole concept that he's just vengeance and there to dish out retribution, which is contributing to the problem. And so when they split ways at the end of the film and she leaves and he stays, I think it's a very, very profound statement. And it's something that we can get behind. But like you said, it's just a glimmer. You get through a lot of darkness to get to that glimmer at the very end, but it's there nonetheless.
Yes, it is very grim. And do you think that Matt Reeves, I mean, I don't know if this is in the comics or not, but just Batman himself has an epiphany wondering about his own legacy, his family's legacy. Did that contribute to some of the crime that he didn't know about? And maybe because he was so focused on trying to get over what happened to his parents and the fact that he was an orphan and that he's trying to rid the city of evil, that it takes, you know, the series of riddles from the villain to have him really come to grips with maybe his own legacy that was not a good part of the history of the city.
That, what you just described, is his conversation with Alfred. So, spoilers, in this movie, there's a moment where it looks like Alfred is killed. And I mean, he very nearly is. It's he doesn't really recover for the rest of the movie. But that's the moment where Bruce starts to see it. He's sort of sitting at Alfred's bedside as Alfred is, you know, messed up from nearly being killed. And he finally has that moment where he says, everything I have done is so that I wouldn't feel fear like I felt, you know, when I lost my parents. I wouldn't ever feel that again. And nearly losing Alfred, he feels it again. So it's not working. The whole system that he's built for himself is coming apart at the seams. And now that he's learned about his family legacy, and even then, see, Bruce sees the worst in people. That's part of his problem. Because he goes to Alfred and he's automatically blaming Alfred for lying and that his parents were terrible people. And Alfred has to stop him and say, you're still missing this. Alfred doesn't say that Thomas was right for turning to Falcone for help with the journalist. He says it was a moment of weakness. He says Thomas turned to him, but Thomas could never have known the lengths that Falcone would go to have something to hold over the mayor, because Thomas was running for mayor. He says he never anticipated how far Falcone was willing to go to have something to hold over the mayor's head, and he had the journalist killed. And Bruce, again, misreads that, and Alfred has to explain to him that your dad was going to turn himself in, but was killed before he could, and was probably killed because he was going to. And so Bruce has to understand that his legacy is, I guess, in a sense, tainted, that his parents weren't the white knights that they have sort of been made out to be in his head. But you can't, at the end of the day, they're still his parents. And, you know, he still nearly lost Alfred, but he still has Alfred. And so you can see the little parts that move him along to that moment at the end where he makes the change and, you know, starts helping those people.
Well, finally, I have a few fun rapid fire questions for Cole. So, Cole, who's your favorite DC character?
DC character? You know, it feels like such a cop-out to say Batman. But I mean, really, that's the character that got me back into reading comics. I really do like Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, the big three, the Trinity, as they're called. I read a lot of those comics, but I probably have to credit Batman with getting me back into comics and holding me there.
I think this next question is more for parents, because I know a lot of kids are just, they watch, you know, series on streaming services and or films. So how old were you when you started reading some of these comics? And given the themes of some of the comics, what would you recommend for parents who think, I'm going to get my kids into these comics? Some of them, the way they're portrayed, I mean, the way the women are dressed and different things like that.
Oh, yeah.
What can you recommend for some of those people who say, hey, my kids are in middle school and they're starting to be nerds, so where do they start?
That is a great question, and I did not know this was coming. Okay, so give me just a second on this one. Modern comics really are, you can't trust them. I bought my cousin, my young cousin, a Wonder Woman comic book. And I thought, it's Wonder Woman. Who doesn't like Wonder Woman? Sure, that's easy to read. And I read it after I bought it to give it to her. As I was giving it to her, actually, I was looking through it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I would never have bought this had I known. So you really can't trust them. So the first thing I would say is any parent who is wanting to try to get their kid into comic books, chances are that parent is already familiar with comics if they're thinking of doing that. Read the comic first. Always, always, always read the comic first. I don't care if it's an artist that you like, don't trust it. Read the comic first. The safe bet then is to, if you want to give your kids something to read, is to go to some of the earliest comics. Go to early Superman in the 30s and 40s when he was published. Go to early Batman, early Wonder Woman. They're old and they're archaic, but, you know, they're a little safer than a lot of the stuff that's floating around now. That's a great question, actually.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest once again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to episode 278 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett, who has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called The Batman and the Banality of Vengeance. You can read Cole's web exclusive review at our website, equip.org, if you're a subscriber to our magazine. And if you do not already subscribe and would like to read his review, please go to our website, equip.org, since our subscribers not only get our print issues right to your door, they also receive online exclusive access to all of those web exclusive articles.